This is talking with Steve Smird at Radiophysics in Sydney on 6 March 78. Can you tell me just what your educational background was?
I did primary and secondary school in Vienna, then went to what's called Technische Hochschule, which is one form of university, and took subjects called theoretical physics. I did the first 2 years, and then went and did my national service because I knew without doing that I couldn't get my passport, and to be fair, the other wanted to leave when Hitler came. So I did my national service and soon after left.
And what year was that?
That was 1938. I left September 38. We were lucky. We got visitors, my brother and I both got visitors, visas to UK, to Britain. And after a few months there, we both got what they called a refugee scholarship at Liverpool University, one of the provincial universities in UK. And I there took a physics course. It was slightly interrupted by internment of enemy aliens during the war. I think it was interned soon after Dunkirk when they realized that among the refugees there were some plants, the fifth colonists, and they couldn't go or take the risk of leaving the war running around. We were sent to Canada, so once being there to about 6 months to get back to UK again. And I then transferred from Liverpool University, which was the vital seaport, and no aliens were allowed to live there. And I was transferred to Leeds University.
To Leeds?
Leeds. I was Professor Stoner and finished my last year there, but got a Liverpool degree. So
nice.
It was a special arrangement in here. At that time, when one finished one's degree, usually went into wartime research, and I applied to get into the Admiralty laboratories working on radar developments. And after a long wait for security clearance, which is understandable, I was then accepted at the Birmingham University laboratories, which were run by Professor Oliphant, actually, who my first contact with Australia. He had made his labs available to the Admiralty and had two people, Randall and Boot, working with him, who developed the split anode magnetron, which was a very powerful generator of pulsed microwave power. And it was really the heart of the Allied radar sets for the Second World War. It was copied by everybody all around from Captured Instrument.
Was that developed while you were there?
I got in at the they had the first one there. I came in. I joined in 1942 when I got my BSc First Class Honours Physics degree at Liverpool University, taking it Leeds. And at that time, the first 10-centimeter prototype of CV-76 was working, produced in the university laboratories. And I then spent the next 2 years in Birmingham working on, largely a matter of trying to scale the magnetrons to different wavelengths.
I see.
And this involved attempting to understand how the thing worked, and so it went, because it didn't just all scale linearly. Some of the things had to be scaled in different versions. Also, you had to try and maintain a mode stability. They tended to jump. They could operate in different modes. The theoretical work I did in conjunction with, in part, my professor Leeds Stoner, and in part, the Manchester group under Professor Hartree, were rather well-known plasma physicist Brunemann. I don't know whether you've heard of him. He works in the States these days. Otto Brunemann was the Brunemann Instability. He got his first interest in plasma physics and amplification of waves in electron stream systems in his magnetron work in Manchester. And I think I was 44 then. Oliphant terminated his sort of contact with Admiralty and changed over to what was referred to as tube alloy work. I think it was atomic bomb.
Work. Tube alloy?
Tube alloy was the code name for the British atomic bomb work. And his team, he and a number of his team, went, I think, to Canada to work on diffusion problems over there. I didn't want to be involved in that line of work and preferred to continue with Admiralty and radar, and was transferred to one of the Admiralty single establishments in the south of England, south of London, in Surrey, a place called Whitley.
Right, this is where Hay worked after the war, I think.
After the war, possibly, yes. Hay was more with the army establishment, I think it is. And Norm Leyburn, I think, knows the answer to that one. He knows them very well. There was one was an Air Force establishment, and there were Navy establishment in the Army. TRE was Air Force, more than I think that's where he was. But he was the techie who was called in to coordinate when they observed extraordinary angels coming in, you know, the eclipse, and that was the first discovery of solar bursts, which he was not allowed to publish for quite a while. I continued work on radar for the Admiralty, and the work became less theoretical perhaps and more applied in the sense that in the Admiralty signals establishment the main job was to design the circuits to test the valves that were then more or less mass produced to make sure that the Navy got good batches of magnetrons for their sets and developed it, sort of tested equipment with it. And then at the end of the European war thing, there were several of us there, including Norm Leyburn, who's just a few doors along from
there. Right, I've already talked to him.
And there were three of us, I think, from that particular laboratory, can't remember the third one easily, who responded to advertisements by the CSIR, as it was then called. I think this was in Nature or something like that. And went up to London to interviews at the Stanley House, and Norm and I were lucky to get an appointment. It seemed very attractive jobs at that time, rather better pay than we were in the UK. And work sounded interesting in the Radio Physics Laboratory, and we both came out about May 46.
And when would you have responded to that ad?
That would have been late 45, I think.
I think I'll try to look up and see if I can find those ads. That would be interesting. Yes. Because, of course, John Bolton and Paul Wild, a bit later, I think, also responded to similar ads.
Yeah. Paul Wild, I think, had to apply twice.
Right.
The first. Yes, the first one.
Good job the first time.
Then he finished up in the test room. Didn't stay in the test room very long.
He's told me about that.
Yep.
So you got down here in 1946.
I arrived at the end of May 1946. Norm was already here. He came out of an aircraft carrier. I was supposed to come out there too when they found there was an enemy alien. They said, "No, for God's sake, don't let him onto an aircraft carrier.
They
might torpedo the thing."
Even though you'd been working the entire war.
So,
in classified research.
I just had to wait until they got me onto a passenger ship, and I then came out a few weeks later. And originally, my sort of assignment was to work on the development of millimeter wave generators, having worked on relatively short wave down to about 45 centimeters, I think. Magnetrons was not an unreasonable thing to go in for. But that, I didn't get terribly far on that at all. I did produce, I think, a general review of millimeter wave generation at that time, roughly the end of the Second World War, and started then thinking about proposals we should follow up when the valve group, as it was called, folded up altogether. I think it was Dr. Pulley who was in charge of it, and he accepted a job at Harwell, I think it was, and so some people went with him from Australia, and the rest of us were distributed to other groups at Radio Physics. And
what was the name of that group again?
I think it was called the Valve Group. You know, at the time, they used valves as oscillators and amplifiers, you know, these bottles, gas things.
Right.
And I think it was called the Valve Development Group or something like that. And I tried to get across to the Radio Astronomy Group and succeeded. And it was probably sometime early 47. And since then, I've been
ever since.
The last 30-odd years I've been with the age of tolerance group.
So what did you find in this group? What sort of things were going on?
They already had a variety of, they covered solar radiation and galactic radiation. They used, essentially the radar instruments, including the Dover Heights gun installment type of radar. I think they had already started developing the Lloyd's Mirror C interferometry. Posey and McCreevy and Payne Scott had already taken the known observations of sunspots or active heat across the sun. So I joined at a time when they had already acquired quite a bit of momentum.
Mm-hmm.
And they already had discovered the storms and bursts on the sun, had located them via sunspots and occurring in connection with flares, say, and probably the first lesson I had with him in a very typical fashion gave me a very methodical rundown on the state of the art at the time. And he did that extremely well. It was, within a matter of a few hours, sort of morning session or something like that, he gave me a rundown in particular the solar section of what was known, both the observed phenomena, what was known about solar physics in a very rough way, only, especially of course, the solar atmosphere, not really the interior of the sun, and how it sort of fitted in, how nice gas to him, of course, his familiarity with atmospheric phenomena from his previous research helped tremendously. As in the case of Dave Martin, for instance, or Ginsberg and Marshall, who were the first ever to make sense of this radio emission from the sun in terms of emissions coming from, say, near the plasma levels and further out.
Right.
And well, being thermal in one sense, Posey discovering sort of million degree cone, as it were, and Martin providing some interpretation of this. And making Posey wait to publish his observational results until he was ready to publish his theory.
So do you agree with the account in Hay's book on that point?
Look, I'm not quite sure whether I can remember. I've read Hay's book. Does he say essentially that...
Well, I can't quite remember myself, but it's something like that.
I think it was.
How could Martin make Posey wait?
He couldn't make him. No, Posey was always a very kind-hearted, and he found his request eminently reasonable.
I see.
I think the one who actually was made to wait was Hay. Apple made him wait until he was made.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was made to wait. Posey, I think, was quite happy. He thought it was a perfectly reasonable request.
That would be marvelous to have a recording of that thing by Posey summing up for you the state of the field at that time. We could only have that. So after you had this session with Posey,
I looked for that on Saturday. I came in on Saturday. I have it here somewhere, I'm sure. I have some half a dozen pages, perhaps, of Posey's handwriting, where he assembled these notes as he went along.
I see.
The state of solar physics.
I very much would like to see that,
It was something I sort of treasured and have kept, and I'm sure it's around here somewhere, but not in the places where filing system is getting someone out of hand. I haven't got a secretary, and with having so many different diverse sort of files down there, it's a little bit hard to keep track of them.
What was your first assignment then?
Well, the first assignment then was to specify the physical parameters of the sun's atmosphere in such terms as would be useful to the interpretation of radio astronomy observations. And to do that, I was sent to Malmström, where Professor Clay Allen was working at the time, and he was a very good sort of physicist. One of his sort of outstanding things was that he separated an eclipse observation in South Africa sometime in the 40s, I think. He made a nice separation between the electron corona and the dark light corona,
mm-hmm.
and produced a modification to old Bambach's electron density formula. I think it was a totally simple one. He topped off one with three terms. we're now back to a three-term formula again, basically, with I2. Quite some density. It's once again a three-term formula, three power term.
So that's where they became the Bombach-Allen model.
That was at the time sort of the best electron density formula. But he gave a tremendous rundown on sort of solar physics research, where it was known, the magnetic fields of some spots there, possible propagation and movement as fields and frozen into the plasma through the sun's atmosphere, mm-hmm. the temperature structure, the steepness or otherwise of the transition between chromosphere and corona. And so I gradually sort of worked my way into the physics of the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And then one realized that for the radio astronomer the main thing was to specify the things in terms of plasma frequencies, dial frequencies, and various combinations thereof in wave modes that could propagate, say, from certain levels. And
mm-hmm.
I did write a little paper on that in PRE, I think. That's one of the earlier papers, 1950. That's a representation.
That's right, a collection of solar data you compiled, and you gave the electron temperature and electron density and temperature, magnetic field.
A radio frequency representation of the solar atmosphere, PIE, I'm sorry.
Right, the British.
Now, and the other thing was at the time then sort of worked together, well, actually there were an awful lot of us usually shared offices. The office this size would be shared by at least two people. And
right.
I was lucky that I worked with, two very good people who helped me tremendously in the early years. Well, one of them has helped me all the time, of course, Paul. And,
Paul Weil.
Yeah. I consider it most unfortunate that this is something that's got nothing to do with the early days, really, but since 1971, when he took over the chieftainship of this thing, of the division, unfortunately, we just don't see very much of each other anymore. And before then, for over 20 years, we met just about daily at work,
mm-hmm.
and also, say, going to the pub after work and having a beer and sort of relaxing or winding down, and sometimes talking shop and sometimes just anything.
Yeah.
But it was a wonderful friendship. I'm very sorry that I don't see much of him these days. He's unusual. He's the best scientist I know, and a very fine man who's had tremendous influence on my scientific thinking, development, and on my work and my enjoyment of the work.
Mm-hmm.
He built up a group which is quite unusual from all the various research teams I have seen, although I haven't worked with them. I think the solar group under Paul was perhaps the happiest collection of people, the most frictionless collection of people, and the keenest and most dedicated, the number of people who would have done anything
mm-hmm.
if Paul just mentioned it.
Yeah.
Never asked him really to do anything particular, they just suggested he might be interested to follow this up or something like that. But everybody who worked with him enjoyed working with him and wanted to work with him and would have done anything to help, irrespective of time and water and anything like that. So he built up some energy, very successful. His ability to, I think on one occasion he said he signed, when he put forward the proposal for the heliograph, I think he worded it that one has to go fish for big fish or something like that. I'm not quite sure. There's a little illustrated booklet when he...
I want to get a copy of that, yes. He told me about that too.
And I think he went for big fish. And he's a mainliner within white sidelines, which I can't walks on the road down the beach, and it's amazing that he can avoid that, and extremely efficient in his work. And well, his development of spectroscopy, radio spectroscopy, and radiogeography, I think, two quite basic methods in radio astronomy and solar radio astronomy in particular. His tremendous emphasis on the need for a real-time display, for instance, so that one could actually see the thing and have the excitement of watching the real-time solar event, for instance, right in front of you, and get ideas to some extent. The need of this real-time display and simple analog display like a spectral film, for instance, in addition to any digital and more complex data, say, which one uses later on for more refined work, but the fact that you can actually see, just look at this and by inspection say, ah, yes, this is a slow drift thing, that's a fast drift thing, and this one is a continuum that was narrow band. His appreciation of how important these things were, so that you didn't accumulate miles and miles of data without ever getting anything out of it.
Are you saying that you think that the important ideas almost can all come from this analog display, and it's only the details that get worked out later on?
A little bit like that. It worked that way to some extent, I'm sure, with most of Paul's discoveries.
With the types of the cream skimming, yes. And the harmonics, certainly.
The cream skimming, the actual basic types, the harmonics, the positions, for instance, the fact that he didn't have to do very much to find that the positions were spatially dispersed, you could see them. For instance, the helium, if you look on the curve, and you can see the sources.
Just moving away.
Then with three different frequencies, where it's lined up, it's first in height. As they should be for plasma radiation, for instance. He had a tremendous ability, well, he still has, to develop these basic techniques, they're becoming big science. The heliograph would be considered a big science installation. And to design them in such a way that the instrument not only meets the specifications of actually observing what you would like to observe, but also presents it in such a way that you can work on it almost instantly. And I think he is just quite unusual. Capable scientist. It has been a pleasure to work with.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting insight there.
The other one that the other Tepe I met quite early on in my work here, and I worked more with Kevin Westphal, as you might gather from some of the earliest titles, than as I did with Paul Wild in the first couple of years. Kevin Westphal, originally a pure mathematician, has gone back to mathematics, but becomes sort of very much university administrator, although he still keeps up with science. I think he was dean of science. I think he still is.
In Monash, yes.
Or assistant vice chancellor these days. I'm not quite sure.
I think he's in Monash. I'm going to try to call him.
It is Monash. Monash University, and I'm sure he was dean of science for years. I think he's now assisting vice chancellor. He has been acting vice chancellor. I think he's now assistant vice chancellor. And just occasionally, he has one research mentor attached to him and keeps his hand in, but they're largely university administrator. But I benefited tremendously from his mathematical ability. I hope he benefited a little bit from my sort of more intuitive physics knowledge and arguments. And between us, I think the earliest contributions there were fairly basic at the time. It was the first sort of derivation of the emission
basic
absorption.
Equation of transfer and
the emission of absorption of waves in the plasma. And, it was thoroughly enjoyable and exciting. And we applied it to quiet sun and opposed to intensities of polarization. And things seemed to give the right answers. It was applied to a slowly varying component and thermal radiation worked there. We realized that Jager and Westphal, I think, produced a paper on the transient response in the plasma to a pulse.
Right.
And this essentially sort of produced a picture of the longitudinal plasma waves of a kind and their response and their decay. was the other interesting result that they decayed with the collision frequency, the collisional decay, although there's also a non-collisional decay, as you know, but the collisional decay has been thought, and still is being thought by many people, to be reflected in the decay of these fast drift bursts, which are short, and do decay exponentially over the order of seconds, say, at meter wavelengths, typically, mm-hmm. and that would correspond quite well to the sort of expected collision frequency of over 1 second mm-hmm. at 100 megahertz or so. And you can turn this around once you know whether you've got a fundamental harmonic, you know what the density is, and then if the collision frequency involves only density and temperature, you can then mm-hmm. determine the coronal temperature.
Right.
I think this was first done, for instance, by the first review paper I was involved in, which was, I think I've been involved in 3 major review papers on sort of radio astronomy or parts of it. The first one was Pawsey in 1953 in Kuiper's
The Sun. Right.
This was something actually that John Bolton, he would name for that. I think he was in the States at the time. I'm not quite sure whether he already had joined Caltech to build up the Bishop.
Not quite that early, no.
Not quite that early. More like, but I think he was in the States and possibly, well, I'm not quite sure who consulted him on who might be able to add a review of solar radio astronomy at the time, and mm-hmm. He put me in for that. It was very nice of him. I was there as a junior research man at the time, and the Taffy Bowen, the chief of the division at the time, thought I certainly needed a senior author with me, so he suggested that it might become Pawsey's work. And so it did. I was very glad to that we did, because Pawsey was another fellow to work with, and obviously knew his subject. And he was strictly a non-mathematical physicist. Mm-hmm. He knew simple equations, but he didn't trust mathematics. This was something that nearly broke Ken Westphal's heart, who, when he wrote something down, the mathematical formula simply is part of the sentence, and you have to read it that way. Well, Pawsey always read it without reading the mathematics or appreciating the mathematical part of it, and sort of had to say, look, I can't make much of it the way it is. I can't make mm-hmm. head or tail of it. Can you put it? Can you explain the physics? What happens there? What is it? An electric field oscillating? How does it transform into electromagnetic waves and things like that? And Ken Westphal, it's all there.
Right.
And the experience gave him nightmares that he didn't get anywhere. And Pawsey often said that he could not very well prove publication of the paper, because we had an internal refereeing system mm-hmm. which has persevered all this time and was fairly strict. And Pawsey did not really like to give a cool publication if he couldn't understand anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And nobody else in the place could help him out. It was then that he got Jay going, the mathematician, who could talk physics and was more mature. And
is this partially related to Westphal's leaving?
Yes. Kevin then decided that, having got rid of that accumulation of papers which he got off with Jager and Westphal between them, and having reviewed Magneto only theory, I think, only so. Which ties in with his thesis work in under Radcliffe in Oxford. He then decided he should probably work in the mathematics department and keep an interest in radio astronomy, but to do work in applied mathematics as he did. I think he joined Sydney first and then Monash, and in between went to the States and worked at Caltech for a few years.
I'm curious that you began working on all these theoretical aspects of the solar physics, and yet your background before then had been mainly hardware-oriented.
Not completely, no. Even when I worked with the Admiralty, especially in Birmingham, my main interest was really on how the magnetron worked. The theory was certainly nowhere near fully understood. And I think Hartree's and Bünnemann's work was probably the nearest approach to correct treatment, and I found it extremely interesting.
I see.
And the practical part of it was only that it helped me to, possibly scale correctly from the very efficient 10 centimeter mount, for instance, a megaton that had been developed, to something like, unfortunately, I went for the wrong wavelengths. I think that's a silly story, but at the time, they, all British and American various service committees that were involved in radar specifications, put forward several different wavelengths for the next generation sets.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was 1.5 centimeter which came from the US, 1.25 centimeter also came from the US, and 1.3 centimeter, I think, the joint proposal. Well, 3.2, I think, became the X-band.
Mm-hmm.
There was S 10 centimeter, and X was V, I think, was the 1.25, and they found that they were in the middle of the oxygen absorption line,
right,
which was particularly helpful. And the 4.5 centimeter, which I worked on, and produced quite a good valve, actually, on the scaling technique, just never became effective.
I see.
This particular development was useless.
In any case, you mainly worked on theoretical aspects.
I was interested in the theory, I tried to understand how it worked, and then applied it, of course, because, especially in wartime, the requirements for fairly immediate applications were always there.
So this was not that different then to be working in
My interest, I think, has always been a little more on the theoretical side.
Let's see, also in this paper, you had a paper by yourself in 1950 in which you talked about the equation of transfer and you gave it the ray treatment first time. Can you tell me how that came about?
Well, that was direct outcome of the earlier paper on getting the absorption and emission and the Bremsstrahlung formulae straight, as we hoped, and then considering the quiet sound radiation, essentially thermal emission of the solar thermosphere corona, having already formed some idea of what model atmosphere should use as far as N and T are concerned, then applied those and produced the quiet sound radiation, both brightness distributions and total flux density. Brightness distributions were difficult to compare, there were only very few available. And this led, the actual comparison there led to another paper too, that's the one that I think Paul and I are down for, the smoothing of a distribution presented at
in Phil Nag, and also presented at John O'Bank.
But
Paul disclaimed all.
Yeah, he, well, I want to say there's a lot there. We had discussed it. As always, he helped an awful lot in discussing it.
But this business about limb brightening and darkening, of course, was going to be a point of controversy in the 50s.
It still goes on. For millimeter wave length.
At that time, there really wasn't any suitable data to compare with in 1950, I don't think.
The Cambridge group had used variable spacing two element interferometry.
But that was a little bit later, I think. No?
Stenio and Machen.
Yeah.
So,
in your 1950 paper, there were no strip scan distributions of any kind.
I think that's
they came within the next couple of years.
They came through afterwards, and I think that then led to the further work of preparing the various distributions that there were, allowing for the effect of fairly broad beams, the smoothing that a broad beam would have on a fairly sharp distribution. And there was bound to be, there still is, there's bound to be a spike somewhere in quite a few of these brightness distributions in certain places because the transition from the order of 10 to the 4 to 10 to the 6 can be over 300,000 kilometers.
If you have enough resolution.
Seen edge to arm, there may be a spike somewhere at some wavelengths where this shows up. And this, as even now, would be smooth.
So you were just looking at the total flux from the sun, or apparent temperatures as they were called often in those days. It seems to me, is this fair to say that the that was pretty. Once you had worked this out, it all fell into line pretty well, total flux as a function of wavelength.
I think in the Pawsey Smert Review 53, I think we published all the data that we could get hold of for flux density, and I think just one set of curves of either apparent temperature or flux density, and the same not unreasonable.
Mm-hmm. But now, as we're just saying, the limb darkening or brightening was quite controversial, primarily because of the effects of the finite resolution of the antennas and appreciating.
Yeah.
And there was an awful lot of work done at eclipses, of course, to try to get around this problem. Could you sort of summarize for me how you think this whole problem developed and why there was so much controversy?
I think it's a mess. Because an awful lot of observers, I think, who went in for comparisons between, say, theoretical curves, such as the ones that I published in my paper,
right,
and the observations, simply ignored the instrument and attributed all differences between observations and theory to
the theory.
Certainly you have to use a different sort of atmosphere, a much smoother one, or much less hot, or a much longer transition between temperatures, so that the observations would fit the theory.
Well, and so was that the motivation for
that
your
paper?
That was
the motivation for the paper, yeah. Right. It's a concept that's still hard to get across. There's another school, too, of course, which came, well, it appeared on the scene quite early on, a German called Reule, I think it is, R-E-U-L-E, who published a very advanced paper on the quiet sound radiation in 1953, I think it was, in which he did take scattering of random heterogeneities into account, and did point out that this would tend to smooth the distribution a bit. And one certainly has to keep an eye on both effects.
Mm-hmm.
The point we were trying to make at the time was that the first thing to do perhaps is to take the instrument and deconvolve the instrumental effect, see what you're left with.
Right.
And what you're left with then should be accounted for by scattered and diffracted radiation from a sun. And if you can deconvolve for that, you finish up the sort of atmosphere, if you're lucky.
Right.
So that's the type of thing that we did.
Now, once you came out with your Jodrell Bank paper, did this help things? They still didn't listen.
I think it was quite interesting because the Cambridge team in particular had adapted an X-ray crystallography technique.
That's right.
The Bragg school was using. And they used that method of forming a two-dimensional Fourier transform of an image by a number of one-dimensional scan, where the lines came, the answers, the theorems. And they used that to produce their two-dimensional Fourier transforms for a limited number of one-dimensional scans. And Paul and I then had to use the known properties of the linear array, the polar diagram of the linear array, say, or its transfer function, to find how the technique produced an effective two-dimensional beam, which you could then represent in terms of the properties of the one-dimensional array that was actually used. And it was further degraded by the method that was used. So if you had a 1 minute of arc linear array, you finished up with a 3 minute of arc second beam, roughly, that type of thing.
So
the method itself.
You could get 1 minute of arc resolution in a single cut, but your effective resolution...
And the side lobe level was slightly worse.
Was that bad? 3 times worse? Something like that?
Not much of a three. Two worse. Two,
yeah.
Something.
Hmm. What were there absolutely no radio observers in the 50s that appreciated this problem? Seems a little surprising to me.
Yes. Not a awful lot of work was. The bright distributions were very few and far between. Because it was not until, I think, Christensen had the first linear array going that the sort of bright distributions were taken a little more seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And one could produce them fairly regularly, and had a rather neat technique of taking a daily scan and then sort of superposing
the lower and lower.
It looks very, very impressive when you do actually see something like an envelope, which you can visualize to be what you can nominally call a quiet sun, which is ill-defined too. But it's just a little bit.
What about the eclipse observations? Were they helpful at all?
There's no ambiguous way of deriving a distribution. There are always a number of them that will fit the thing. So it's ultimately a matter of model, where you start with model different models will fit, and some people choose one, other people choose another. But there's no unique solution to it. It's an integral equation, but there's no unique solution to it.
But I was wondering, from your point of view, do you think that the amount of effort that went into this, for instance, NRL, I know, went on several of these expeditions all over the place, do you think they really were worthwhile in terms of understanding the sun?
I think they were probably worthwhile to some extent, not necessarily because of the contribution to getting the brightness distribution correct, but they learned a lot about the structures, like the in the earliest eclipse situations, the covering and uncovering of plazas, sunspots, some non-sunspot areas showing bright, radio bright regions, the size of the thing, polarization of the kernel and the halo type of thing. So I think in that sense, the eclipse observations did contribute. The higher resolution observations of early bright regions.
So more about the active sun than the quiet sun.
A little more about the, yes, long effect.
That was useful anyway, yeah.
That goes right back to Covington's 1947 eclipse.
Right, 47. I forgot to ask you about Clay Allen was one of the first optical astronomers to show an interest in this thing.
We were extremely lucky in Australia, unlike our American colleagues, for instance, who came up against pretty strong opposition from the established optical astronomers. I think they didn't recognize radio astronomy as a respectable part of astronomy for a long time. And Clay Allen was the first one that I know who wholeheartedly accepted this new branch, got on well with the people, in part from personal knowledge. I think Pawsey and Allen knew each other, appreciated each other, and we got wonderful cooperation.
And now D.F. Martin was also part of Anstromlo?
D.F. Martin, I think, at that time was just, well, actually, he was chief of radio physics, I think, either near the end of the war sometime. He worked with radio physics.
I think that's right, yeah.
And he then continued his work at Mount Stromlo, but still really on the, well, the invitation of radio waves from the sun.
Yeah, he only remained active in radio and solar physics for a couple of years after the war.
After that, he formed his own section of within the CSO, the upper atmosphere section.
I see.
Which was located at Kempton, a little town about 40 miles south of here, roughly.
So he went back to the ionosphere, basically.
Yes, ionosphere, exosphere, it was called at the time, neutrospheric work, early big neutrospheric work, and quite a bit of theory went with it there. And, actually, I think Bill Ellis came through that school before he set up in Tasmania.
I see. Well, I'm going to talk to him this weekend, so.
I think he worked with David Martin and developed a spectral technique applied to neospheric whistlers in particular, all calls, that sort of work on the spectral display, I think, was the thing he did at Martin's division at Camden.
I see.
Up Edwards division, I think.
This would be the early 50s?
That would be by the time. Then he set up, became professor at Tasmania.
To,
went into, well, asking him to do the work, a bit of solar work, transductor spectra. He's got always got more projects on than anybody can possibly take. But he's so full of ideas.
Well, I'll talk with him in the near future.
But we were lucky. I think it was not in the States, as far as I know. It was Bock was the first one who took the
mission. Yeah. Well, there was interest amongst from Bada Minkowski.
Yes.
And also Greenstein had some early interest. But on the whole, though, I think your statement is quite accurate from what I've been able to gather. So let's move on here through the some of these other papers. And also in 1950, you talked about the magnetic field of the sun.
Well, that again, that sort of goes back with the work that Ken Westphal and I sort of did together. Or Kevin had done a revision of Nicky Dominic theory, which included, for instance, the changes in effective indices and absorption coefficients in the presence of magnetic field, the longitudinal case, the transverse case, and mm-hmm. arbitrary angles between the field and propagation. And he did on one